Hey, welcome to Radio Plays, the interview sessions. We are sitting down with Daniel Carter Brown, who wrote Happy Places. I'm Anna Fontaine, and I played Fern in this play.
Hi, I'm David Soika. I played Luke.
And I am Clay Brackney-Wandelier, and I was the director for Happy Places. We have with us Dan. Hello, Dan.
Hey, I am Daniel Carter Brown. You can call me Dan, and I wrote Happy Places.
Hey.
So first up, how did you get started as a playwright? Could you tell us a bit more about your sort of path to playwriting?
Yeah, I started in comedy. I did a lot of improv, and a bunch of friends and I wrote some sketch comedy that we performed in Chicago when I was living there. And, you know, I was mostly writing to make myself laugh. I did some playwriting classes in college as well. I wrote a full-length play in college that is weird, but we all have to start somewhere. And the more I did it, the more I realized I really like writing dialogue as my main way to write. You know, I like the challenges of telling a story through dialogue, and, you know, to a lesser extent, stage directions, as opposed to just getting to type narrative and decide everything that the audience sees and hears.
Right.
I like the challenges of that and the restrictions. You know, some restrictions are freeing, and I find that it frees up my writing.
Cool.
Having the limited tools of theater.
Interesting. Kind of diving into Happy Places specifically.
Yeah.
What inspired you to write it? Did, like, a particular character kind of just pop into your head, or was there, like, a line that somehow from the ether emerged, and then from that you're like, ooh, here's an idea?
So I decided I wanted to write a romantic comedy. Mm-hmm. I hadn't yet, and so I said, let me see what happens if I try to write a romantic comedy. So that was my starting point. And then the question was, what do I have to say about love? And what, like, a romantic story needs conflict, and what conflicts haven't been just overdone. And so as I was thinking about all this, thinking about my own love story, my love story wouldn't make a good play. We met, we fell in love real fast, and then we got married, and, you know, we've had issues, but nothing that's, you know, nothing that makes a play.
Right. Super dramatic.
and in some ways, I kind of feel like maybe that's how love should be. And so that's why Happy Places ended up being the kind of love story it is, where the traditional love story format follows two characters, but they don't end up being each other's love interest.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hoping that if you're listening to this, you've already heard the play.
In theory, they should have.
Yeah. Theoretically, this won't get dropped until the other two have been out for a while, so they should.
But if they jumped ahead, that's on them.
It's on them. Spoiler warnings.
We have fans who only come for the interviews. That's all they care about.
Well, then, and then they know what they're here for.
Yeah.
They must be interesting people, and I would like to know.
So, when you're writing, where do you draw your inspiration from? Do you have multiple sources? Is there something that's like your go-to, just gets you going, you know?
I think usually the pattern is it starts with a concept of what I want to write about, whether it's an idea I want to communicate through a play, or for this one, just a genre I want to write in, whatever the starting idea is. And then I let it percolate until it turns into a story. I'm big on story. There are plenty of great plays that are not about story, and I enjoy them, but for my own writing, it's gotta be... If I don't have a beginning, a middle, and an end that is compelling throughout, to me, then I'm not gonna, it ends up, you know, as a brain dump in a file on my computer somewhere. But once I know how it ends, then I plow ahead and actually write the thing.
Like having that kind of like end goal in mind helps you kind of work through all the other bits and bobs, yeah, and such.
It helps my first draft not be so awful that I can't stand it.
That's fair. That's understandable.
So you mostly just work from, you get an idea and you go with it. You're not someone who sits there and you need to pull out your book of writing prompts or like have your jazz music playing just so in the background kind of person.
No, I need a quiet room. Music tends to infiltrate my brain too much for me to write while doing music. So,
yeah, same.
Nature sounds at most.
So one of the reasons, and you kind of like talked about this, that like we were drawn to Happy Place is that, you know, it's a romantic comedy, but it didn't seem like, you know, the typical romantic comedy. And I'm just curious, kind of when it comes to, do you find in your own work, or maybe this is in like work that you're drawn to, but that idea of kind of like subverting expectations, or like there's a trope, but like playing with it, like it happens in this play, but do you see it happening in other plays that you do, or even just, again, things that you enjoy?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I consume a good bit of entertainment, especially TV. Mm-hmm. And so I like that feeling. As an audience member, I love that feeling of, this is familiar, I think I know where it's going, but then it's subverted. Ah, okay, we did something new. And so I look for opportunities to do that as a writer. But I also think it can be overdone if it's twist after twist after twist.
Right, yeah. Do you find, I mean, like, have there been other plays of yours that, like, maybe it's not romantic comedy, but just another one that, like, springs to mind of, like, ooh, that's kind of, again, something you discovered or twisted, not over the top.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. My play, The Outrage Machine, which was picked up to be produced by Essential Theater here in Atlanta this past summer, but of course that got canceled. Kind of sets up to be a character who, it's kind of a character in over her head story, and the ending sets up to be expected. Well, I've learned a lesson and now I know how to do better from now on, and instead she kind of breaks bad a little bit at the end.
Interesting.
So that's the first example that comes to mind of that. I'm sure I could come up with more.
Yeah. That's fair. That's
you cool. Kind of touched on this with talking about Happy Places, and then with this, you mentioned that you do enjoy intentionally sort of subverting a trope. With Happy Places, because your first idea was to write something that wasn't just these two people having the big story, but then the real trope that you sort of subvert is less so just, oh, they have this meet cute and don't fall in love, but the big thing is the idea of, like, it's a love story about two people who are friends. So which kind of came first for you in the case of Happy Places?
Love story of friends came first. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, but right on its heels was love triangle subverted.
Right.
Yeah.
And then right on that heels would be meet cute subverted. I kind of subvert the two simultaneously.
Yeah. No, like it is sort of just the one twist, but.
Yeah, but that's fair with, like, and I, you know, I should have thought about that too, but, like, with Aaron and that love triangle where it's, like, they don't necessarily hate each other. In fact, everybody's a kind of, like, a decent person trying their best, you know, like, as opposed to, like, oh, we hate Aaron because, you know, actually Aaron's probably the better match for her. I mean, again, spoiler alert for everybody.
the better person.
Maybe.
Yeah, and I... Definitely better for Chloe.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I wanted... That's why you don't get to meet Aaron until you are set in the typical love triangle slash meet cute setup. Because I feel like if you met him any sooner, you'd fall in love with him too.
True. So you've talked a little bit about a couple of the plays that you've written or have been writing. And I was wondering if there was sort of a genre or a particular idea or concept that you keep coming back to. Like, my husband writes, and he, in almost every single one of his plays, he writes for a middle-aged woman. No one knows why. But is there something that you sort of find that you keep coming back to?
I do try to have some variety in who I write about. Typically, I do often make my main character female. This is an exception. That is because of my time working in theater and in Atlanta theater. It's a lot easier to find brilliant female actors.
true.
Who are available and willing to work at all sorts of different price levels. It's just easier to cast, and also it's a challenge for me. But I don't. I write the human, and then make her female.
Mm-hmm.
Usually, so that's one thing. As far as a genre that I write in, I've found that these days I do kind of walk the line of serious and comedic pretty consistently. I tend to write plays that might be in the kind of comedic thriller genre. This being a departure from that. I like the excitement. I like finding ways to put a thriller on stage. Yeah, it's a nice challenge.
That's not an easy feat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you mentioned that you like your plays to be stories and have the plot and everything. So when you've got this character concept that fits perfectly within the plot that you have written out, do you ever find yourself in the position where you struggle to actually give that character a voice in life? Or do you ever have certain character archetypes that you feel more comfortable writing versus some characters that are a bit more difficult for you?
I do have some character types that are a little more difficult. But what I find really helpful is as I'm, you know, once I'm at that point where I know what my story is going to be, then I do a deep dive on who my characters are going to be, and I write way more backstory than is ever going to come out on the page. And a big part of my learning how to write process has been to eliminate the unnecessary stuff.
Right.
I'm like, but I wrote it into their background. It's not important to the play.
It's my backstory.
It's just, but, yeah. And that, the more I do that, the more I'm able to give each character its their unique voice. For this one, Fern is definitely the most unique character, the least sounding like me character I've ever written. And I love her so much.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it really did start with writing her backstory, and the more I wrote, the more the social awkwardness and probable being on the spectrum became part of the story. And in that, she then started to sound like some family members and friends of mine. But yeah, it's just sort of, it's a discovery that happens as I develop the characters, and they end up kind of having their own energy level.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
that drives the distinctions in how I punctuate their lines.
Mm-hmm.
And
how much or little.
How talkative they are or little, yeah.
So if Fern was one end of the spectrum in Happy Places, who was your, ooh, this is my safety blanket character.
Like, you
I know
could just
write
them
this.
In a smooth like butter, just kind of like all flowed out, yeah.
I would go with Aaron. Mm. Yeah, you know. I just wanted to make him a fundamentally good guy, so I was. it was pretty easy to. The challenge with Luke sometimes is to write his mistakes.
Yeah,
but it'd be real close between Luke, Aaron, and Chloe. They all sound a bit like me in different ways, but. And then sometimes I write a line like Luke has. About being more socially awkward, or, you know, needing to be around people who are more
socially competent.
Yeah. With socially competent than he is, yeah. And then I say, well, now I have to tweak some of his other lines to justify that. And that also helps him sound
right. That's true. You kind of like find it along the way of like, oh, that
paint myself into it.
Now I have to add these stumbles that he has, but yeah, it makes him even more unique. That's interesting. That's true in the writing process. In Happy Places, it takes place in Atlanta, and that's kind of referenced in different ways, and, you know, it kind of just kind of comes up throughout the script. Was there a particular reason behind that, or, like, why you wanted it to be set there?
It just felt right to some extent. It's where I live, and a lot of my plays do not have a specific location, so Atlanta did become very important to the story, and I think the decision point was when I landed on Resurgence and the theme of the Phoenix.
Mm-hmm.
Atlanta's motto is Resurgence. It's Seal has the Phoenix. Atlanta literally arose from the ashes. And so since I knew I was going to end the act by devastating this friendship, then I could use the Phoenix metaphor coming out of
to
that.
Kind of like, yeah, that reemergence.
Yeah, rebuilding. So Atlanta helped with that. Chloe, being from the Midwest, I moved from the Chicago area, and I made it Wisconsin instead of Chicago because I didn't want her to be so much of a city girl.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so her move kind of mirrored my own also.
Got it, yeah. So you said in other plays, like, place isn't as important, but you found with this one, was, like, the theme kind of what prompted, like, oh, let me go back and really, like, make that setting important, or was that a starting point?
Yeah, Atlanta was not a starting point necessarily. It came to a point where I had to reference a place in the script, and I said, okay, is this a specific place, or do I do what I've done in other place and say something general like Washington Street,
right,
or Maple Street that exists in most places? And it ended up being a little bit of an ode to Atlanta in a way as well.
Well, I think from an audience perspective as well, it's sort of a safe bet to have a Midwestern person coming to the South. Like, it's a very comfortable feeling narrative. It's not like someone trying to move to Maine where you feel like their...
That's just unrealistic.
Their struggle is the move, right?
Right.
No offense, everyone in Maine.
Sorry about it.
Yeah, and that mirrors my experience. I was pleasantly surprised by the adjustment from Midwest culture to Southern culture. There are a lot of similarities.
Yeah.
It's easy to kind of flow in, yeah.
So how long have you been in Atlanta, by the way?
I moved here in 2009.
Okay, so quite a while.
12 years now, yeah.
So between the different places you've lived, I'm going to read this question exactly as it's written.
As it
semi cheesy, but what are some of your happy places?
I'm actually going to one of my happy places next week. We're taking a vacation to the Outer Banks, North Carolina, which is my family's vacation. And specifically, Jockey's Ridge, the sand dunes there, just gorgeous, and a lot of fun memories playing there as a kid, and it's always a beautiful sunset. Mm. That's one of them. Chicago's always going to be a happy place, and there it's more about their specific bars. Like, I have a friend who just moved to Chicago, and I couldn't stop talking about the Hop Leaf, which is a great little gastropub that I love. My first job was at a Baskin Robbins.
Oh.
And I worked there for 2 years. That's where all the
ice cream knowledge yeah, into the script. All the frappes and that.
Yes. And so in my mind, the set is very, very much that Baskin Robbins, which was at the edge of a strip mall. It was a florist next door, not a jewelry shop, but yeah. And I have happy dreams where I'm working at Baskin Robbins still all the time. Because in my dreams, money doesn't matter.
True, true.
So that is a literal happy place for me as well.
What are some sort of things or events that you find inspiring? Things that have happened to you? Things that you view on other media? Anything that sort of clicks and you think, oh, I need to write, not necessarily about that, but about something.
A lot of times it's if I'm watching or listening to something and I think, oh, well, what if it goes this way? Whether it's live events or fiction, and then it doesn't turn out to go that way, and then I'm like, aha, so that can be mine now. I can write this story where it goes that way. That's kind of where I started with the latest play I've written.
Throughout life, or maybe even just kind of recently, like, are there any writers that you especially like either go back to and you always love what they've written? Are there certain shows or just kind of something like that where you're like, ooh, either you'd suggest someone read this person, or this show or this movie? It's kind of just very influential. Anything like that?
Honestly, not a lot. Mm-hmm. My history in theater has been mostly classics and new works.
Yeah.
And so that's a lot of what I've read. That's a lot of what I'm familiar with. Shakespeare is great and really is the most honest answer to that
that's
question.
That's fair. I mean,
yeah.
Read your Shakespeare, I love, everyone.
Yes. He tells a lot of my favorite stories. And of course, he didn't come up with the story format for a lot of those, but that's a whole other topic. And so there are contemporary playwrights whose work I have liked a lot, that I've worked with. Topher Payne, who is a dear friend and an amazing playwright. Mm. And he tells really great stories and writes really great characters. And Leah Romeo, who is New Jersey-based. She's kind of an up-and-comer. I directed one of her plays that was fantastic, and then whenever I hear about another one of hers, I'm like, I want to read it. I want to find someone to produce it and direct another one. Also, in film, the Coen brothers' writing inspires me. They're in that kind of thriller, comedic thriller vein a lot of the time too, that I like, and they never waste a character.
Yeah,
if somebody comes on screen and says a line, that, you know, that some of that's directing and acting, but also, you know, it's they find a way to make the character memorable, and I respect that, and I love it.
Yeah, yeah. Do you have a sort of ethos or sort of conceptualization of your inspiration process? Because I remember there's a poet, and I don't remember exactly who it is, but she talked about her inspiration process, and she was saying that the poem came to her like a storm on the horizon, and she could see it coming, and she had to drop whatever she was doing and run to a notepad and write it down before it passed. And if it passed, then it was just completely gone. And that just sounds like I wish I had that life, because that sounds so cool.
Mm-hmm. That does sound cool, also exhausting and nerve-wracking.
Overwhelmed by it. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. And it's just like, yeah, do you feel anything sort of that way, or is it sort of you actively pursue...
It's more, yeah, I think a metaphor would be like, I've got a science experiment of a bunch of different vials going on inside my head, and, you know, they're having different reactions and they're bubbling up differently. And then sometimes one bubbles up to the surface and it's like, ooh, that was a noteworthy reaction. And that's the one that... but they live in my brain for so long before they're on paper that I don't share that sense of I have to write it down or I'm going to lose it.
Yeah.
It's more like there are these different elements and just kind of like the right timing of it. And like this element and this element kind of can snap together and kind of, ooh, and that gives you that strong enough idea to want to write something.
Got to say, that sounds much more enjoyable than a storm that shows up and ruins your day.
Yeah.
If anybody listening knows who that playwright is, please tell me in the comments, because I can't remember for the life of me. Yeah,
whatever works. So when it comes to those experimentations or what have you, do you have anything new that you're working on at the moment or developing? Or
it's been kind of a slow process. The pandemic has sapped a lot of creativity, and I have a toddler, and that has sapped a lot of my free time. But I am, the latest play I've been working on is inspired by a podcast, called, Up and Vanished. Mm-hmm. And this is one of those cases of, I thought I saw where this might be going and I was worried about it, and it turns out that's not where it's going. So let me write that play. Mm-hmm. So this is, a podcaster takes it upon himself to go investigate a missing person from years ago. That everybody's pretty sure was a murder, but the body was never found. And it turns out, do I want to spoil the ending? Yeah, I will.
Spoiler alert.
Because this is where the idea came from. And you do find out pretty early in the play that she is alive and she's been hiding, and now he threatens to expose her to everybody she's hiding from.
Okay.
So he's the bad guy all along.
Or complicated.
The podcaster is the antagonist. Yes.
That's the word. You causing some challenges and some problems.
So is there any location, any website that we can sort of keep up with what you're doing, things that are going on in your life?
Yeah, danielcarterbrown.com. Danielcarterbrown.com is my website. So you can see me there. I have a blog that I sometimes write in every once in a while. It's not been as much as I intended when I created it, but it's also a place to talk about my scripts, talk about my acting work and things as well. So that's there. I'm on Twitter at DCB Plays. DC Brown Plays.
DC Brown Plays.
DC Brown. That's what it is.
Nice.
You know, you mentioned that you did improvisation and sketch comedy back in Chicago. Do you feel that those skills carry over as particularly useful to you in your writing process? Or do you sort of feel the process of writing it down takes some of that improv training away?
The characters definitely do improvise in my head before I write the lines. They talk to each other, and I see where it goes if this is the response, and I say, oh, okay, that's moving us in a direction I don't want to take this scene, so let's reset. And there is an element of yes and to it to keep the scene moving along. Improv taught me a lot about what makes a scene compelling and getting to it quickly. And so that's really useful as a writer. And comedy, even if I try to write a serious play, it ends up being at least partly comedic. Right. So why hide from it?
There's comedy in life.
It's just, yeah. And improv and sketch comedy taught me that often the funniest thing is honesty.
Mm.
And simply delivering a line honestly or expressing an honesty gets a really good laugh. Yeah, those are a couple things.
Do you find that, because you mentioned like directing some things and then acting and things, do you find that kind of having those various experiences, have they kind of informed your playwriting from when you wrote that like first play in that writing class to say now having gained a bit more experience in different aspects of theater?
Absolutely, yeah. Directing has made me very conscious as a playwright of the limitations of theater, and you know, don't write a character coming back in with a costume change unless it's a quick change comedy, which I haven't written one of those yet. You know, just think about the practicality of it. If a main character never leaves the stage, that's really hard on the actor. Sometimes really effective, but it's really hard on the actor. So, you know, when I'm thinking about the framing device, having produced theater, I think about the budget of a show, and a unit set is, you know, if you want a big realistic set, a unit set is easier to produce. And so I know that's helpful. Or if it's got to be multiple locations, then, you know, thinking about how writing in a more abstract way can help facilitate that and make, you know, and allow the play to be done on black boxes if that's what needs to happen.
Right. Doing directing and producing in every hat available, did you have a moment where you realized, oh, I hate when playwrights do that? I've done that, actually. I've definitely.
Yeah. I have a pretty long list of pet peeves, and some of them are things that I've just decided I'll never do as a writer, but they're fine. I don't know if it's playwriting informing my directing, or directing informing my playwriting, or acting. You know, it's kind of all builds on each other. But I've developed a nose for the self-conscious playwright, and I've caught myself doing it a bunch, where you write a line just to prove that you know what you're talking about as the playwright, and it doesn't seem natural coming out of the actor's mouth, or it doesn't further the story in any way. I'm just like, I want to prove that I did research into what this
is. it feels like something shoehorned or false, as opposed to, like you said, something they would organically say.
That's one of the hardest things, too. Writing something just so that it exists and not trying to, like, prove yourself.
Yeah. And this is something that Clay and I talked a lot about before beginning this process. Stage directions. One of the things that makes this play a pretty good audio play, and it's true for a lot of my plays, is I don't overwrite stage directions. That's a big pet peeve of mine. Because the director always kind of has license to throw them out anyway.
And I do.
And not everybody's going to be Tennessee Williams with their intense.
Oh, right. And also a lot of playwrights don't realize that when you get a play from a library and you see copious italic writing, that's not written by the playwright. Yeah. That's somebody describing the set, you know, a stage manager describing the set at the first production and things production. Like that.
Yeah.
So I try to only leave in the stage directions that influence how someone says the line. And that does not mean what's termed Riley's. You know, I try not to direct the actors through my writing because that's somebody else's job. but more like, oh, this is ambiguous. The actor could deliver this, could justify delivering this angry or sarcastic. Mm-hmm. It's worth specifying that this is sarcastic. Mm-hmm. Oh, and punctuation. Being consistent with punctuation. You know, there are a lot of different systems, but yeah, ellipses versus dash, using exclamation points sparingly, but
yeah, you
know, intentionally.
I didn't have to much in this play, but I do often tell actors, I'm like, no, that's not an exclamation point. Don't believe that. That's a period. That should be a period. Or I'm like, that's not a period. That's a comma. Let's move it along.
Yeah.
Where do you land on the ellipses versus dash debate? It's a hot discussion.
Hot debate. And I'm rehearsing Glengarry Glenn Ross right now, and Mamet uses ellipses for interruptions.
Yeah, which is like, no, I don't like that. But that's me personally.
It's
ellipses are a trail off.
Yes.
I'm glad we all agree with
hyphens are interruptions.
Look at this group of scholars that we have.
Clearly.
And not all hyphens mean the next character interrupts. Sometimes the character interrupts themselves.
Yeah, that's true.
And that's still a hyphen.
Yeah. No, that's fair as well. Yep. Okay, great. See, glad we're all on the same page. We don't have, obviously David Mamet's doing just fine.
Oh, yeah.
But glad we don't have that person of ellipses. Right. Mm-hmm.
So, as a writer and a theater creator at this point in your career, do you have any advice that you would like to give to someone who's just starting out? If you could have gone back 15 years and told yourself this advice?
If you're beginning as a writer, as a playwright, or any kind of writer, your first work doesn't have to be your magnum opus. It shouldn't be. Don't try to include every idea you have in one play. Save some for your next thing. That's something that I tried to do early in my career, and those plays didn't get produced. Yeah, the more you can streamline your idea and focus your play, the easier it's going to be for producers to understand and sell. And so even if you see a whole bunch of things as connected, that can be a theme in your writing, and write multiple plays.
Right.
Yeah. That puts a little less pressure. Again, it's understandable. Like, this might be the thing that matters so much, but if you allow yourself room to grow, that's actually kind of can maybe free you up a little bit as a writer too. Less pressure, anyways. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So you subscribe to the Marie Kondo method of if it doesn't spark joy, don't put it in your play.
I think that can be. You can use that to do a effective sweep of your play for cuts, especially if it's a little too long.
Yeah, so maybe like round two of editing, go in with Marie's kind of frame of mind.
Yeah.
Well, unless anyone has anything else, thank you so much, Dan, for letting us produce your play and talking with us today.
Thank you for doing it. I can't wait to hear how it came out.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Dan.
Thank you, Dan.
Yes, it's been a pleasure.
Yeah.